Well, how was that election? I woke up and there was a new world order. It feels like that sometimes. It's been a long 18 months, the news said, since we've been gearing up for this election. And it was, felt so divisive. And even now, it's no matter who you voted for, 50% of the other voters feel very different than you do. Looking at them on all the TV last night, there were the maps of the states, all the blues separated from the reds. Is that big swath of Midwest red, are the people there so different than the two coasts, the two blue coasts? It's very graphic. Those they all have the same map. They all have the same system. Red, blue, map of the United States. Even some of the California initiatives were kind of, people fell on different sides. The people in Fresno feel very different about capital punishment than the people in Santa Cruz do. I think the people in Fresno feel very different about marijuana use than the people in Santa Cruz do. So very, very divisive. And I woke up last night. I'm such a good sleeper, but I woke up and about 2:30 and just couldn't get back to sleep. Just thinking about, the profound differences between Obama and Trump and the changes that are going to be happening in the next few months. And we've got this, our whole religion is based on studying impermanence. And yet, I felt myself very resistant about all the changes that are going to have to occur. In Buddhism, we have an antidote for that pain of separation, feeling apart and separate from somebody else or something else, and that, of course, is our meditation. And Soto Zen, the tradition that we follow here, is known as the just sitting school. And it really makes sense to me. My experience on the cushion, just at the grossest level of sitting down and kind of leaving my troubles at the doorstep, so to speak, if possible, and following the breath, sitting in a comfortable position. Just kind of the relaxation alone, helps bring healing to a normal day, much less all that we've, the roller coaster we've been on for the last 18 months. And our meditation, there's lots of metaphors to describe it. Dogen, our Soto Zen founder, in the mid-1200s called it Dropping Off Body and Mind. All those habitual worries, habitual thought patterns, even habitual ways to hold the body, you just kind of let go, you drop off, and follow the breath. Another term is turning the light inward when we get on our cushion. We turn our attention not to what we usually do, which is out in front of us or listening to the car to the side of us, but we turn our focus towards our mind and try to find that place where we just start thinking, and we try to quiet the thoughts right there where they first start. Turn the light inward and focus on that which doesn't think. And we settle into that position and that frame of mind. It takes a little energy that we bring to this posture, and it takes a little energy to focus on the part of our brain that doesn't think. Thoughts arise, as you all know, and we have to say, oh, just let that one go and come back to the stillness before thought. Those are some of the metaphors we use for our meditation here. And my experience is one of coming home, this is really the source. This is really wholeness. When I'm not thinking about this or that or this opinion or that opinion, or my preferences, the rest of the universe is able to get a little closer, because I'm not thinking about my opinion of it before it even reaches me. So without that thought, without picking and choosing, I'm feeling a little more connected and less separate from everyone and everything. That feeling of wholeness, of calm. One of the sutras says that this is a tranquil, eternal, and nirvanic. This feeling of letting go of thoughts, dropping body and mind, focusing on that which doesn't think, and just feeling that connection that's a little more intimate than my normal walking around during the day. So this is a natural antidote to that feeling of separation that we might feel around this election time and the election results. Dogen quoted a Chinese Zen master, Xuanzha. The universe in the 10 directions is nothing but the entire universe in the 10 directions is one bright pearl. Can that feeling of wholeness and connectedness extend out to the farthest reaches of the universe when we don't block the intimacy with anything, with our fixed ideas, with our fixed thoughts, with our preferences? And can that extend throughout the universe such that we have the experience of it's all just one bright pearl? There is a, you know, we might struggle a little bit with this posture and squirm in these 40 minutes of sitting. There might be thoughts that we just can't let go and put aside and get back to our breath. There might be some disturbance in our meditation. But I think the reason we all come back here week after week or day after day is because of that experience of wholeness, intimacy with all beings, the luminosity, the spaciousness of that sitting, and experiencing, Zen teachers call that experience of one bright pearl the unborn, unceasing nature of reality. So it's a compelling experience, despite some discomfort, to come back and visit our home again, our source, the unborn, unceasing nature of reality. It's a compelling feeling to come back again and again. Dogen says in his this chapter called Naturally One Bright Pearl, Dogen says in 1230, more or less, 1231, Xuan Sha is the first one to say the entire universe of the ten directions is one bright pearl. It means the entire world of the ten directions is neither vast nor minute, neither square nor round. It is not neutral, not active, and not obvious. This one bright pearl doesn't have anything that we can latch on to, that we can identify it with. It doesn't have any marks. It's not like our understanding of space with an accumulation of celestial bodies peppered throughout it. It doesn't have any of those marks. Dogen says the entire world is neither vast nor minute, neither square nor round. It has no characteristics. It is beyond the coming or going of birth and death. What is that beyond coming or going of birth and death? Usually that means it's what we call this moment right here, right now, this eternal now. If our attention is always right there, right in the moment, paying attention to our body, paying attention to our breath, in our quiet, tranquil, nirvanic state of mind, we're just right there at that eternal now. It's not a moment that's coming up, you know, or it's not a bunch of nows for 40 minutes. Oop, I've just done the 37th now. I've just done the 39th now. It's just one eternal now. That's how we usually think of beyond, beyond coming or going. When we investigate the entire world of the ten directions, meaning when we meditate on the entire world of the ten directions, or when we meditate in the entire world of the Ten Directions? Who can see it as bits and pieces? Who can talk about it as something solid? So when we're in the one bright pearl of awareness, we're not dividing the world up into red states and blue states anymore, the bits and pieces of the electorate. We're not even imagining maybe you've already started, what would it feel like in that big pearl? You know, could you move around? You're not even trying to imagine it as solid. You're just right there in beyond coming and going in that eternal now. He says the eternal now contains the past 10,000 years later on in this chapter. And the world isn't bits and pieces. It's whole. It's intimate. It feels like our natural home, our original state of mind, our original mind. And that's the unceasing, unborn nature of true reality. Dividing up the world into bits and pieces, into red and blue states. That's our elaboration. It's our elaboration of the true nature of reality, but it's our elaboration over many years of practicing being a Republican or being a Democrat, many years of practicing choosing this and that. And so this sitting in one bright pearl is the antidote to that constant elaboration. And as a lot of us felt today, that pain of separation. The entire world of the Ten Directions means that you ceaselessly chase things and make them into the self, and you chase the self and make it into things. That's the line that means that when we're not in that meditation of the one bright pearl, we're constantly elaborating and picking and choosing sides and blaming the election results on the other side, on those other states. When emotions rise, wisdom is pushed aside. Isn't that a great line? When emotions, when this habitual body and mind arises, when we're not in that intimate state of the one bright pearl, or we're not experiencing that, or practicing that, or remembering that intimate state of the one bright pearl, emotions rise. We pick and choose. We become this solid, separate body. And that's when wisdom is pushed out. Wisdom is that experience of one bright pearl, of no separation, of intimacy, gratitude, and compassion. But when we recognize that we're in this mind of separation, the teacher and the student then turn their heads and exchange their faces, unroll the great matter, and harmonize their understanding. So, you know, even, you know, it's It's very, we try to keep it very quiet in here during our meditation so we're not disturbed. We keep the lights down so that we can better focus, so that we can better turn that light inward, as is said. Maybe it's not so difficult to find our posture, to settle our body and mind, and remember the non-separation and intimacy of the one bright pearl. But the bell rings, we go outside, some of us jump in our cars and go back home and fix dinner. You know, what then? And Dogen says, when you realize that you're back in separation, you exchange faces, meaning our faces are the same. We don't have our individual faces anymore, and we harmonize with the great matter, with the true reality, the unceasing, unborn nature of true reality. So even during the day when we're fixing our dinner and driving our cars and getting from place to place, we can remind ourselves, even though we see bits and pieces, even though we see separation, even though we might meet somebody who voted differently in the election, we can still remember, oh, this is all just one bright pearl. This is just one luminous, spacious, intimate, compassionate place. And that's our practice. We remember some on the cushion. We experience the one bright pearl right here on the cushion. We gain confidence that the entire world in the 10 directions is one bright pearl because we kind of feel it. We kind of experience that intimacy and that compassionate connection with everyone. And then even when we're not here on the cushion, we can remember it again and again. Maybe little mindfulness bells. Maybe every time we turn on NPR, we can say, you know, no matter what I hear on this station, I'm going to try to remember one bright pearl, the mind and body of one bright pearl. Or every time we stop fully at the stop sign, I'll remember once again one bright pearl, this mind of intimacy and connection and wholeness and compassion. One bright pearl is not just a name of something, but an expression of understanding. Although there have been people who thought that it was only a name, one bright pearl directly experiences 10,000 years. Here, in the one bright pearl, is the now of the body and the now of the mind. This is the bright pearl. So, I am frequently tempted in this last 24 hours to identify people that I think got it all wrong yesterday, and I got it all right, and yet you know, that's forgetting the one bright pearl and the intimacy of this the nature of true reality. Reb Anderson, renowned Dharma teacher up in the San Francisco Bay Area, in in his book, The Third Turning of the Wheel, says that, even when somebody else did something that we think causes suffering, we have to take responsibility for it. And that's kind of hard to get my mind around. Usually if I identify somebody as causing difficulty, I'm relieved that it wasn't me. And I'll leave it up to them to back their way out of it. But Reb says that we have to take responsibility for that. He says that if we don't take responsibility for that, then we're actually practicing that there's somebody out there that does something unskillful, either to me over here or that I think is unskillful. So if that's not our own intimate body and mind out there, we've forgot all about the one bright pearl. So that, kind of leads us to, how are we going to, what are we going to do these next few months? How can we, whether we agree with Trump or whether we just think that it's going to be a lot of work to change all our health care plans and fill out all those forms again, no matter what we think, how can we act in the one bright pearl, as one intimate body, rather than separate bits and pieces? Our job, actually, as Zen students and bodhisattvas, is to remember, over and over, the one bright pearl, our intimate connection with all beings. And our actions and words are to help others. Maybe there has been some suffering caused. The suffering of separation. The first bodhisattva precept is not taking life, and this, along with the second precept, not taking what is not given, are both meditations on dependent co-arising. Can you live moment to moment, not taking life, not taking your own life, not taking a life that's not given? Can you give up that separate life and take and receive the life that is given? When we receive the life that is given, we feel gratitude, even if it's painful. Can I receive the life that will be given to all of us in the next few months of change with gratitude, even though I can imagine that I might not like everything, even though it might be a little painful? Can I receive it with gratitude? And we understand that we're doing a meditation that will liberate beings from that pain and all pain. So if we think about, how we're gonna act and what we're gonna say over these next few months and these next few years, that's our bodhisattva practice, to demonstrate, to model harmony, to promote harmony and relieve pain and suffering around us. And that is our bodhisattva practice when we take up this meditation of one bright pearl. Um, I had a very poignant example of this a few years ago. I went to I'm from here, and I left for graduate school in 1984 to go to Wake Forest in North Carolina, and it was the beginning of the HIV infection. Many people were starting to get sick in Santa Cruz and the Bay Area. And the practice before I left was, it was even before the Santa Cruz AIDS Project. It was just the practice. I mean, we all knew each other here in town, and it was the practice of the guys that were well to help take care of the guys that were starting to get sick. And then I went away to North Carolina and discovered there wasn't any organization that was doing any caretaking, although I was aware that people were getting sick. In North Carolina, sadly, in 1984, the well gay people were a little too embarrassed about identifying themselves as gay, so they of course wouldn't join an organization of caregiving. You know, kind of sad. But there was this organization of Southern Baptist women that did the caretaking, that did shopping and making meals and taking people to doctor's appointments and picking meds up at the... And, of course, you know, being kind of an a-religious Californian, I went to North Carolina with lots of fixed ideas about Southern Baptists. And, you know, they were politically conservative and socially conservative. I just couldn't imagine where we'd meet, even though I was going to be, you know, surrounded there in North Carolina. And it looked like, you know, when I first started working for their AIDS organization, all the women, you know, doing it, it looked like, you know, the movie Steel Magnolias. They were lighthearted and fun to be around, big hair. What's that great line? The higher the hair, the closer to heaven. You know, at some point, you know, I certainly didn't have a Zen practice then. I'd never heard of it then. But at some point, I realized that they weren't Baptist women at all. They were bodhisattvas, you know, acting just like me, you know, showing me that there is no separation, that there's just open-hearted, compassionate intimacy with all people. And that was an early lesson. You know, maybe it was, we give these talks here called way-seeking mind talks, you know, where we say, what doors opened for you that brought you here to the study of meditation at the Zen Center? And maybe this was one of those doors that, you know, really experiencing that no separation, that one bright pearl, that funny, humorous, light-hearted, compassionate existence in the pearl of Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I'm going to remember that bodhisattva practice from Winston-Salem as I launch out in these next few months and these next few years. And I think Dogen in the 1200s had such a practice, had a bright pearl practice in mind for us here in the 21st century when he wrote that fascicle. No bits and pieces, no separation. So there's a couple minutes left for comments. Maybe some of you have already thought about your one bright pearl practice, or maybe you've had a bodhisattva practice modeling harmony and compassion all along that you'd like to share with people who are wondering what could my bodhisattva practice be in these next few months. Nettie.
Talk about anything to do with the election, post anything online that not be contributing to fear, anger, which holds the one bright pearl, then we wouldn't do that.
Yeah. I mean, fear and anger are like those emotions. The expression of the emotion is the banishment of wisdom. It's a very good practice. Kathy.
Well, I found myself today in this difficult day. What was on my calendar was to go down and work with a group of educators whose mission is to, I forget exactly the wording, I wish I would have thought to bring it. It's so beautiful. It's a school down in Watsonville where they really believe in teaching their students to be citizens of the world and to be culturally sensitive. And they themselves, most of the people, the students and the teachers there are Latino. And, you know, I just thought, what better place to be today? In terms of this, you know, that the anger, for me it's not like, I don't want to contribute to the anger, but I also don't want to turn away from the energy of anger. But what I want to do is use what's under the anger, which would be a sense of fear for injustice and mistreatment of others, as a motivational energy. So rather than just splattering it, I mean, I think maybe for some people that's healthy, but I find it just aggravates more anger. But to take the passion under the anger and to support people who are going down every day for a long-term social justice. Desire. Mm-hmm. And I felt a lot of gratitude that was what was on my calendar today.
Yeah.
I really did. I felt a lot of gratitude.
Yeah.
Because it actually gave me feeling like, oh, there are some things that we can do. You know, and all the kids were talking about it, and you know, a lot of them were afraid, and they're talking with their teachers and their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this big conversation going on about who are we as a people and what do we believe in and what do we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of country do we want to work for, regardless of who lives in power?
Yeah. No, lucky you.
I didn't, at first, you know, I felt kind of grumpy this morning.
I gotta go to work.
I wanted to stand in my covers. I was happy that was what was on the calendar.
Thank you. One of the many stories on NPR, the many rehashes today, was an interview with a young woman in another part of the country who said that she was kind of upset by the rancor and the divisiveness, you know, all along. So she took it upon herself to kind of organize, you know, get-togethers after work, happy hours, or just birthday parties. I mean, just to sort of keep everybody together, even though they had disparate views on things. And she said, "It looks like I think I'm going to try to keep those going. You know, that it's not ending here," and she hopes to keep that connection. This is among her workmates. So that was a nice practice, I thought. Lenore?
Well, it's fine. slowly dissipated today, I realized that underneath I felt confident that the universe could absorb this. That's as close as I can come to your one brain pearl. But it was reassuring. And then as I, and when I heard you talk about the Baptist women, fortunately, you reminded me that we are not as different as we think we are. That was a wonderful thought.
Yeah.
As I faced the wall earlier, I was aware of how co-arising, I think, appearances that co-arise and whatnot. And of course, my immediate reaction to everything that arises is I have to decide, do I like it or not?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful for this experience yesterday and today that brought me to remember how much I do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, my question all day was, how come nobody saw this coming? How could we not know? Well, guess what? Things change. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are basic parts of my practice, is that it's always changing, and I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And the corollary of I don't know is that I'm not in charge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that was the hardest thing to give up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that separate self that's pretty powerful.
Remember that I'm not in charge, and gradually toward the end of the day, I feel a calm that, of course, I had to come here and feel with everyone else that had to come tonight, more people than usual, maybe.
Yeah.
And this is so helpful to be in community and to have the support of the awareness of other people. I just try to be in this infinite awareness from which it all comes.
Yeah, yeah.
And the awareness is not affected by the arising of Donald Trump.
And being in a community, being in Sangha is kind of a manifestation of that one bright pearl, a version of it. And our sitting really gives us, lets us learn the confidence of sitting in that moment before we decide, do I like it or not? So that when we're not in such a formal posture and we're not so quiet, we can remember, I don't have to decide whether I like it or not. I can just what did Reb say? I can just receive this life and be grateful for it, whether it's painful or not. I can just receive this. I don't have to decide whether I like it or not. Thank you, Stan.
You reminded me, Patrick, of my first opening experience. It was the summer of 1964. I just graduated from college. And I worked as a volunteer at the South End House on the south end of Boston in a primarily black district, or an African-American district. And we had a basically summer camp for the kids while the moms went to summer school to learn English. And I remember all of them, and how happy they were to be in that place and all the different things we did with them there during the day. And I remember one kid, Johnny, who really somehow connected, and I loved to hike, so I invited him to go on a weekend backpack trip to climb Mount Whitney, or Washington, I guess it was, yes. And he made it all the way, and it was just so wonderful to see him do that extra stretch and just rise to that occasion and be able to share that with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that reminds me, like you, Kathy, I was subbing today at a school I love to sub at. You probably know it. It's Second Opportunity School, SOS school in Washington, for kids that want a second opportunity. And it's run lovingly like a family. And the first thing we watched was up front in the election, and the kids wrote down what they felt about it. And then we proceeded to go through the day as a loving family.
Nice. Yeah. You lucked into a one bright pearl today, too.
Well, I was there yesterday.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yeah, very much so.
Well, thank you. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless.